title of the talk today is Complete Stranger. One time, a friend of ours was on a yatra, so it's like a walking retreat, kind of, in France. And because it's not a fully silent situation and it's a group of 100 to 200 people, for a lot of people it's extremely challenging to have to be social and in part of the day in silence. So you can't quite keep your persona going, and yet you can't quite keep your silent, alone persona going. So one friend who outwardly is very confident and polished and a dancer on top of all of that came to speak to Gemma privately with her distress, with her extreme difficulty in feeling shy. And somehow they came up with a really, a kind of tool that they both were happy with. It seemed to work very well as well. So the idea was for our friend to go near where there were other people, maybe especially people she didn't know, and then to make herself trip and fall down. And that way, she could make friends. That way she could open herself and find a gap in the, with the other people to actually meet in a way that was, she could get across her own boundaries, her own fear. And it reminds me of another friend who is a storyteller and who did a storytelling intensive, long, like months and months of storytelling training. And one thing that they did every week was a clowning workshop. And I don't seem to remember when I was like growing up and doing workshops ever seeing clowning on offer, but in the last 10 years it seems to be something. And I ask my clown friends, what is it to be a clown? And I haven't quite gotten a good answer yet. But this one friend, Elia, in the clowning class of her storytelling workshop, said that one of the most profound moments of her life was in the first clowning class. They just had to sit in the group and put on the nose, the red plastic ball that you put on your nose to be a clown, and just sit in front of the group. It would be like sitting up here and just putting on a plastic red ball on your nose and not saying anything and looking and being seen. And she said it was terrifying and the amount of vulnerability that she felt was just, she could see herself and she could look at the nose on her nose and she could see how she was feeling, and she just couldn't relate the tiny little stupid plastic thing to the amount of feeling that was going on. Something about the clown seems to be to expose ourselves, so we fall down on purpose in order to connect, in order to get past my own and our own hesitation, our own sense of strangeness with each other. But having the nose also, it helps us meet in our vulnerability, and it also helps us stay strange. Sometimes in our quest for friendship and connection, we try so hard. We want so much for the connection that that wanting gets in our way. We try so hard to do it right, to get the connection with other people and with ourselves, that in that place of wanting, we don't realize, we don't have the connection with what's already complete. So the title is playing with this word complete and this word strange, stranger. How we can be with the strangeness of human being, where there's a way that we are, as well as being completely strange, we are also complete. And also something is moving us towards more completion somehow. We're not complete, finished, end of the story complete. And so it's so strange to be with that human situation. And so I think it's so hard to be strange and to be complete, that our main strategy for dealing with life is to rely on judgments to kind of get by and to get through the day. We receive ideas that become ideals. Even if we've let go of an ideal, an idea that became an ideal of a certain sitting posture for meditation, we could invent a new idea or a new ideal that we have to lie down. Or we could think that we know what resting is and try to impose that. Instead of letting everything stay strange, the idea of rest and the idea of meditation and the idea of sitting and the idea of lying down, if we could let it stay strange and complete. Strange and complete. I don't know if you've noticed, if maybe it's not your experience, I've noticed with many of us that when we start to feel uncomfortable because we don't know what the idea is or what the ideal is, something in us starts to churn out judgments. It starts to just pour forth with judgments. Or with a state of pressure, which is kind of like a state of judgment without necessarily the words going on. And what's interesting about that picture of my friend Alaya with the clown nose on in front of the group, feeling so exposed. And we've talked a lot about this alarming tenderness that can happen. If we start to feel that churning out, that huge flow of judgment starting to happen, production of judgment and tension and pressure, it could come as an inability to decide what to do because we've got to get the right one, the right decision. If we could take a look at that, because in our judgments we are exposing a lot, and so we could let that be exposed to ourselves. In a judgment that happens in my mind, there's a lot that's exposed that I could then look at in detail to learn about what I need to learn about. So if I'm preoccupied with, sometimes it will happen on retreat, that will, let's say, almost always it will happen on retreat rather than sometimes, that there will be a thing that really bothers me. So they call it vipassana villain if it's a person. It might be the weather. In this case, sometimes it's great when there's something like the weather that's, this is supposedly the wrong kind of weather to have, rain, although someone said in a beautiful way in the group yesterday, I'm loving the rain because where I live it doesn't rain. But we sometimes in India when it's very difficult conditions, so one time in Bulgaria we had tons of rain and some people were sleeping in a tent that wasn't waterproof, a big kind of wedding tent made of cotton. So that it wasn't just dripping water, it was dripping dirty, reddish, grayish water. And there were like more mosquitoes than you could imagine. You had to watch the in-breath in a different way. There were so many mosquitoes that sometimes they came in with the in-breath. Sometimes when there's that kind of, literally, I'm not joking, clouds of them. Sometimes when there's that kind of weather outside us as a group, we can be together in the difficulty that we're sharing. But if there's not that kind of focus, then it usually will happen that there's someone in the group that really gets to you, or something about the hall or the teachers or the teachings or the food, or something about the setup or your bed or whatever. And if we could expect that to happen, if we know that that's sort of one of the things that happens on retreat often. There's the Vipassana villain and the Vipassana romance, the thing or the person that is such a delight, which often is lunch. For many people, it's lunch. A Vipassana romance with the salad dressing. If we could notice that that happens and not think that there's something wrong with me that that's happening. It's a human, strange human phenomenon. That does happen. And then if we could actually see how rich and enriching that situation could be and see what is showing itself in the judgment. What is the specific judgment? What's wrong and what's right? Because so much of what we're seeing about our world is not our world. It's ourselves. And so there's the simple kind of tools that I hope you have already heard about, that when you know you're judging about someone else in a negative way, you're really talking about yourself. There, even if it's like, I love the silence and that person's so noisy, what you're telling yourself is there's a way you're being noisy. It's probably also not only that noisiness of complaining about the noisy person, which is disturbing your silence more than the person is. It's probably also some literal way of being noisy that you haven't noticed yet. It's almost like something in the mind is trying to call your attention. You really do want to notice how you're being noisy with your, when you put your shoes on or when you close the door. Because you really do love the silence. And so we can kind of play with the actual content of the judgment that's happening and not just only say, ah, it's judging mind. Oh God, I hope it passes soon. Like I hope it becomes sunny soon. Eventually it will pass. Eventually someday it will be sunny again. But let's not also miss the richness of what's being shown, what's showing itself. That there's almost a strange kind of intelligence that's almost saying, hey, the subject is noise. And the subject is also you, yourself. And there are other ways, one other way that we could kind of extract some of the richness from a judging state of mind, or just a judging thought. If there's a way that I see someone doing something that I think is wrong, and especially if there's that really kind of gut reaction of that's really wrong, that shouldn't be allowed. And especially if it's something that's not like an aggressive act, but it comes across to us as aggression. And then there's aggression in us in the way that we would like to stop that person from walking so fast or so slowly or whatever, taking too much food or too little food. If we notice an aggression in our own response to what we think is wrong, it can be that it's revealing something about how we have been treated in the past, that we were punished for walking too slowly, too quickly, eating too much, too fast, etc. And we might just be able to get enough space to kind of edge some compassion in towards that child or that earlier person, that earlier character of us, where we were punished for doing something that was considered wrong, but maybe wasn't really wrong. We can see where we're being so strict with ourselves, just simply out of habit. Simply out of habit has to take into account how a habit is formed, and there's usually some kind of aggressive impact that kind of implants the habit that says, no, you cannot be yourself. And so we could feel that bruise and just feel that it's painful. not to take it too much on as my pattern that I have to work with, but feel that part of my arm hurts, that part of my life hurts. And sometimes then we can get, again, a sense of the strangeness of that idea that we have to be silent. If we see in life, even if we go into nature where there's no traffic noise and no human noise, and we call that silence, and it is never silent in nature. There is a wind. There is an ant cutting a leaf. There are the birds, the river, rain. And so seeing the strangeness of an idea of imposing silence, for example, from the outside, we can kind of feel, again, our love for the silence and what silence actually means. Doesn't mean literally no sound whatsoever is allowed. And actually, I feel like just saying, what does it mean? One of my teachers talks about when we do something that seems to be a mistake, such as tripping and falling or dropping something. On a silent retreat, maybe we accidentally make a noise and we could so easily feel punished without anyone having to say anything. And we could so easily shut down, close down. And if we can feel how that closing down is actually disconnecting from what we really mean by silence, from what we love about silence. And if we could let ourselves really be in the flow of where silence brings us, what we love about silence. That even when a mistake happens, an accident happens, if the first thing that happens next is not a feeling of wrongness, then very often something creative can come out of that sound, or we won't be hurt when we fall. Something is staying with the flow of awakeness and can just ride through the fall or with the sound. But then again, we could hear that and then we could impose that. Next time I'm about to fall or I am falling, and I can say, I did hurt myself. So I must have been blaming myself. I didn't do it right. I didn't stay awake. Somehow it's like climbing down out of that, again and again, out of that judgment way. So that we don't then feel embarrassed and feel wrong for feeling embarrassed. But we could still see that by being embarrassed, I lost myself. I lost the flow. And then, what helps? How could that childlike fear of being judged, being kicked out, being punished, how can we let that childlike fear and response be there when it's there without letting that childlike fear of punishment or being wrong stop us. Sometimes it's easy when we're working on our patterns, the patterns that are apparently, obviously more aggressive or more boring. But sometimes it's so hard to feel our way into healing this part of us that's afraid of being judged or punished without just being more afraid of getting it wrong again. Does that make sense? It's easy for us to kind of approach and realize, okay, recognize, let's work on that ego that's too proud and too arrogant and too wanting or thinking it's right. But what about that part that is separating off, feeling separate? Because it's assuming it's going to be kicked out. It's assuming it's not good enough. And if we can bring that, let's call it the hurt child, in and make her or him feel comfortable and at ease to play here, right in the middle of things. Then what happens further on? Because it's not only bringing the hurt child in and making her or him feel comfortable and at ease and playful. Then what happens? One of the things that then can happen is that we are free to be happy even if something happens that we don't like. And we're free also to just be still or quiet or unmoved or unexcited if something happens that we do like. We don't have to only be happy when we get what we want and only be unhappy when we don't get what we want. Because we're kind of stepping back from the whole wanting game, the whole way of having a strategy to get through life. If I play by the rules, then I'll get what I want. If I could feel what I actually want and why I want it, I want you to like me. But then why do I want you to like me? And keep going with the questioning. I want you to like me maybe because then I could relax. So then what I want is to relax. But that's not the whole answer. What else is it about wanting you to like me? Maybe there's some deep impression that we already are connected. And that if we would actualize that connection, there would be something real. A nourishment that is real, and not only for me and you. And we could keep going. Why else do I want you to like me? So that I can remember to like me, etc. So keep the questioning, like, not to say, oh, wanting is wrong. But to see how the wanting and then the strategy and then the trying never works. It cannot work. Because we've already disconnected from what we wanted. Thinking that we are not complete, that we do not have it, that we cannot complete it. But maybe there's some kind of wisdom, some kind of strange intelligence in that wanting you to like me. And if we can see how the wanting you to like me, as important as it might be to the hurt child part of me, is, as we say, small change compared to what we really want, what we are really called for. What happens when there is acceptance of things as they are? The Buddha one time was giving a teaching. I find his sense of humor. I'm sure he meant to be funny. I'm sure he did. And I just wonder why other people don't see that clown nose on his face in the way that he speaks or spoke. Just to kind of give some more examples or details of ways that we could disconnect from that only being happy or excited when things are going according to the idea that I made into an ideal, and then down when things seem to not go according to the ideal. So the Buddha asked the person he was talking to, if someone offered you a nasty drink and told you there's poison in this, there's poison that will kill you in this drink, and it tastes really bad, if you drink it, what will happen? And if the person who wants to stay alive and wants to be healthy drinks that drink, what will happen? Okay. Disgusting taste. The way they put it is, it doesn't agree with you as you drink it and after you've drunk it. And then after some time, you die. And if someone came with a brass cup with a delicious drink and told you, there's poison that can kill you in this drink, here, do you want to drink it? And if someone who wants to stay alive took the cup and drank it, what will happen? And then someone comes with a disgusting drink, and you might think, I know, you're the one with the poison. But no, it's not. It's a disgusting drink. It's fermented pee with other kinds of medicine mixed in. This is actually in the text. And it will cure you of your disease. And you want to be healthy. Would you drink it? Would you get up early in the morning and go to the Qigong and the meditation? And if you drink it, what will happen? It will at first be disgusting and not agree with you, and then you'll be healthy. And of course, he always goes right through to the end. He doesn't leave anything out. A delicious drink of yogurt and honey and other delicious things mixed in that also does not have poison mixed into it, and it's not in a brass cup. It will be delicious now, and it will cure you of your diarrhea. Would you drink it? In our dealings with life, when they're dealings, I think we so much want to just kind of get it and quickly. So the disgusting drink, okay, that must be the poisonous one. Oh no, it's not the poisonous one. Okay, that must be the healthy one, the one that's going to heal me. Okay, one time it helped. One time you almost died. If we could kind of reel ourselves back in from the idea and the judgment level. And expect the unexpected. Know that life is strange. Sometimes poison tastes bad. And sometimes poison tastes good. And sometimes medicine tastes bad, and sometimes it tastes good. And that is true. We know it. Sometimes it's hard to do what we know is good for us. Sometimes it's delightful. And can we feel that that's not all? It tastes disgusting, it hurts at first when we drink it, and then it helps. Or it tastes delicious, it feels so good and soothing in the belly, and then we feel better, we're healed. Could we kind of accept that strangeness so that we could feel somewhere else that could decide for us, somewhere in us that could decide for us, some other kind of knowing? But it's sometimes a stranger to us, and we don't want to be strange, because then we might get kicked out, we might get punished. One specific way that I want to call to our attention that we tend to oversimplify our interpretation of what's happening. So there's the usual way that if things are hurting, I must be doing something wrong. And there is a kind of hurt that we'll come to recognize with practice and experience that is a signal that there's something off. And there's another kind of difficulty, stretch, even disgustingness, yuckiness, bad taste. That definitely does not mean that something's off. It means that something's getting right back on alignment. So of course we don't want to just assume if it hurts, it's wrong. Unless it's that really kind of special tender hurt that we come to recognize as a signal and we immediately respond as we would for a child or an animal. Someone, you see a hurt animal or a hurt child, we immediately grab the child out of the river or whatever. But just because we're in a bad mood or just because the knee hurts or whatever, just because there's a lot of negativity in the mind, it doesn't necessarily mean that we've gone off track. But also, the other way around too, let's not oversimplify. It's not also just because there's challenge, just because it's hard, that I'm doing it right. Maybe, things are more strange than that. Maybe there actually is not, maybe there really is not right and wrong. And to say even further and more specifics again. The Buddha again said that there is going to be, part of being in this strange life is there's going to be pain and pleasure. Sometimes we will succeed, sometimes we will fail. Even if I fail, it doesn't mean I'm going wrong. It's not a wrong thing. It happens in this strange life. People will say good things about you and bad things about you. They will, and they do. And so do you, about yourself and others. It so happens in this strange life that way. It's not a signal. There's some other kind of even stranger signaling. I have a friend who's been in a partnership with someone he loves very much for, I think, at least 20 years, and just recently found out that the person is with someone else. It would be so easy to say that it's right or it's wrong, that the partner was wrong, that my friend did something wrong. Or it would be so easy to oversimplify and say, oh, it's all for the best anyway. Maybe the other partner should have stayed with my friend. Maybe it would have been better. Who knows? It would be easy to say, seeing how my friend is using the situation, to be in contact with incredibly sharp wisdom, heart. The wisdom that said, don't even touch strategy for a second about trying to get the person back. In this strange life, we keep rubbing up against things. It would be easy to say with my friend, oh, isn't it great that this happened so that he's in touch with his deep wisdom? It's all for the best. No, what if we don't say that? We can say, it's good. It's good that he's really clearing his wisdom voice. He's really asking himself for advice. And he's really listening. And sometimes he can't listen. And he can't get out of bed and he's depressed. And sometimes he can listen, and the momentum of his practice takes him on a walk and takes him to his yoga and takes him to his meditation. If we just don't touch the idea that it's for the best or for the worst, but we do accept that in the strange life, things keep happening that would be so easy to call good and bad. It would be so easy to just keep riding that happy good, negativity bad. I remember the courage of someone in a Dharma discussion group of about 20 people at least, a couple of years ago, talking about her very strong inner push, something that kept pushing her. And it's such a trivial thing to take out the garbage, is what it was. Such a trivial thing that to say it out loud, to admit how much that subject takes up space in her life, to take out the garbage. The garbage can is not empty. There's something in the garbage can. I need to take it out. To say that to other people. To know that that is the strangeness of human life. That there's garbage to take out sometimes. How do we know when it's the time to take out the garbage? How do we know when it's really full, that garbage can? And what if that's not embarrassing? What if we actually accept that we all have some subject that takes on that flavor? Some area where there's a push. A push towards some ideal, some idea of perfection. That never really can quite be complete for more than a few moments, because there's going to be more garbage. So with the silence, with the mind states in meditation, Here we are with our garbage can and our garbage. And somewhere we're supposed to take the garbage when the garbage can is full. Here we are in the meditation hall with a time period for meditation on a schedule, a bell and a stick and a clock. And then the kitchen bell rings. It's lunchtime. But this bell hasn't rung. Oh my God. One time Gemma was sitting with the bell in a different place, an ashram in India. And it was similar. The lunch bell would ring before the meditation bell would ring. About the same, about 5 minutes. Didn't matter how often we would tell the kitchen, oh, it would be really cool if you would ring the bell after the time. Like, if we end at 11:45, what if you rang at 11:46? No, 11:40. Gemma was sitting there, sitting up, not lying down, so there's not that, maybe she's asleep, with the bell in front of her. And someone, a good friend, was in the hall meditating and actually got up, walked to the front, took the stick, rang the bell. Out of good intention. A good intention trapped in wanting to take out the garbage now. Sometimes we can let an ideal-like silence inspire us to go out of our habits and be in a stranger world, to be stranger, not to just be the usual talking or the usual doing. And then sometimes the ideal is not so much inspiring us as repressing, controlling. We can keep coming back to what we love about that, what it inspired in us. Not sort of being angry at the garbage because I have to take it out. Or being angry at the bell for not ringing, or being angry at the meditation for not being over with. We can be angry at our own practice that we started because we loved. Because we're practicing in a way of wanting, of practicing feeling not complete. Trying to get to that ideal. So we could, for example, feel whatever is your garbage can, when your garbage can is empty, whatever that is for you. What does that bring? What does that feel? What does that allow? And then from that sense of completion, or fresh, clean, finished, resting time, vacation, or whatever. Everything's in its place. So whatever kind of feeling comes in the moment that you seem to have what you wanted. If we could then start from there, instead of thinking that's the ending. If we could start from that feeling of completion. So it's strange. A strange way to start. Coming to a place where we feel things are in their place. And then from there, picking up the stick. So even in meditation, when peaceful or joyful or uplifting or spacious states come, in Buddhism sometimes these would be described as cleansed states, states where our equipment is clean and oiled and running smoothly. Not just our thinking equipment and not just our emotive, our emotional equipment, but also more subtle equipments of mind. The Buddha said, these cleansed states are my pathway and my domain, yet I do not identify with them. These things that I love, these places where there's stillness, flow, okayness, a feeling that things are in their place, a feeling of being allowed to be, or however you would put it, those states we can cultivate, and they are our way, our pathway. And as we walk that path, they become our domain. Where we live, we know the territory. We can ride those horses. But we don't stay on the horse. We don't make an idea and an ideal out of those experiences. We let our experience stay strange and complete as it is. When we're not relating to our experience through our ideas from our past experience, we are inside the present experience without thinking that's all there is, or that is, it is that I needed to then be complete. But we stay within our experience now. That's when it's pathway and domain. There is a way. We can work with anything, whether it seems good or bad, whether it tastes bad or good. I'd like to close with part of a poem by Rumi. About this strange, this completely strange life. And how there is completeness, there is things in their place, and there is flow from completeness. Beauty surrounds us, but usually we need to be walking in a garden to know it. We could say medicine surrounds us, but usually we want it to taste good. We want it to be the yogurt honey one, not the fermented pea one. The body itself is a screen to shield and partially reveal, to shield, like to hide, to cover, protect. A shield is what people, like, would, if I'm fighting with a sword, then I would have a shield. Mm. The body itself is a screen to shield and partially reveal the light that's blazing inside your presence. Water, stories, the body, all the things we do are mediums that hide and show what's hidden. Study them and enjoy this being washed with a secret we sometimes know and sometimes not. Let's just have a moment together, quiet. You don't need to jump into lotus position, just as you are. To feel where we are together in this garden. May all beings be at peace with things as they are. May all beings be peace in things, things as they are. May all beings, including ourselves, being peace, also bring peace into things as they are, into things as they will be.